Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs, penned in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butts and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play He worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As far as I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out in the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory. And that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it. And I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth, as laid up in me. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdrawest thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, spit history in hair, B.C. and A.D., and what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him and talk with him and work with him and speak together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, This man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Look at the new archway. All organic. This is all under construction. About 40% complete. All right, so this is the second Wafati that we have started construction on. People live in here off and on. People come and stay.
Boy, it sure is a nice day today. I believe I'll go back out in the garden and dig me up some worms and go fishing. I got me a nice little spot picked up down there on the creek. Boy, them perch is biting like crazy. Yes, sir. I'm going to fish, 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 fish. Sinker and line. I said fish, 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 fish. Boy, I'm going fishing just to ease my mind. You know, some folks say that fishing on a Sunday is a sin. I don't believe in that though. If a fish bite my line on a Sunday morning, really morning, I believe I'll take him on home and fry him up good and have a ball. 'Cause I don't see nothing wrong with fishing on Sunday at all.
Young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, today we're going to review what we yesterday's the power, and today's podcast is titled "The Power of 1 Acre and One Tiny House Per Day." One tiny house per day, and that's as a revenue generator. Just as a review from yesterday, the power of 1 acre. With 1 acre, 1 acre can hold 10 basketball courts. It can hold 16 tennis courts. Now, this is not all at the same time, but if you want to just strictly basketball courts, you can build 10 basketball courts on 1 acre, 16 tennis courts. On 1 acre. 1 acre of land can accommodate anywhere from 144 to 200 plus parking spaces. I think it's up to 242 parking spaces, depending on the vehicle. Five houses, and we're talking about single family houses that have a front yard and a backyard and a driveway. And throwing a garage with that as well. It can also accommodate 500 trees that are spaced 9 to 10 feet apart, 500 trees. It can accommodate 3,600 tomato plants. It can contain, not in all places, but in many places, 325,851 gallons of water, particularly groundwater. Rainwater, it just add up, and I have to look up the stat on that. So an acre of 1 acre of land has quite a bit of spatial wealth. Spatial wealth meaning space. And it also has spatial capital. You know, what's already on that land, below that land, above that land. Just for instance, an example of an acre can, you know, like once again, can contain 144 to 242 vehicles. All right. That's spatial wealth. Now, you can turn it into spatial capital once you label it, like tailgating, parking spaces, you know, keep on going with that. You know, you got spatial wealth. And a lot of people don't realize that spatial wealth, I mean, it could be 144 places where people can sleep. They can accommodate 144 plus tents. It also, you need to factor in, now this, and, well, we'll go into social wealth and social capital. We'll go, because I've mentioned social capital plenty of times, but we're going to look at social wealth and how does that relate to social capital. And then, like I say, the podcast is settled, the power of 1 acre and one hot, tiny house per day, all right? If you need, if you have a large sum of money that you need, instead of thinking about borrowing money from a bank or a friend or a neighbor or something like that, think about what revenue generator can you organize right now to generate the money that you need. So with us tiny houses, we figure, you know, you heard the expression, an apple a day will keep the doctor away. Well, if you build and or sell and or rent, build and rent out at least one tiny house a day or shed or dog house or something of that nature, we're woodworkers around here, then that will take the bill, that'll keep the bill collectors away. We'll be back with open phone lines right after this.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She
that nigga kid. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, Why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumb ass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is, and it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right. Today's podcast, yesterday we only did some people that called in, Pat. Actually, we only did 26 minutes yesterday. We typically don't do anything that low, but that short, rather, not low, but short. But we did 20, and that yesterday's podcast was titled The Power of 1 Acre. So today's podcast, we're going to do a review of yesterday, because we didn't speak that long yesterday. The Power of 1 Acre and One Tiny House Per Day, and what tiny house per day, what that means in the course of what we have to do going into 2024. So we've got an opportunity to purchase, let's say, 20 acres of land, a little bit over 20 acres of land. So looking at the cash requirements, I said, well, let me break down what is an acre. Exactly what is an acre? And not so much in the traditional sense of, well, you know, 2 acres, 2 half acres make a whole, four quarter acres makes, you know, makes a whole, or, you know, 10 tenths makes a whole. So I did some research, which is real easy, anybody can do it. And so let me give you some visuals on an acre. Now, one visual is an acre is about the, it's the size of a football field. So if you live near a football field or drive past one, when you see a football field, you're essentially looking at 1 acre of land. But let me give you some more optics on this so you can get a visual. On that acre of land, you can put 10 basketball courts on it. 10 basketball courts on an acre of land. All right. Or you can put 16 tennis courts on an acre of land. You can also put up 5 houses on it, and those houses would, you know, could be maybe about 1,700 square feet, and you still have enough room for a backyard, a front yard, and a driveway on that 1 acre of land. You can also place 500 trees, let's say 500 plus trees on an acre of land, and that's if there's space, you know, 9 to 10 feet apart. You can put, you know, 500 trees on an acre of land. If you like to grow things like particular tomato plants, you can plant 3,600 tomato plants on an acre of land. And an acre, particularly if it has groundwater, has 325,851 gallons of water. You know, below the surface. Love that, but you do. So an acre of land has spatial wealth. And because I measure, a lot of people measure wealth in terms of dollars and cents and net worth and balance sheets. I measure wealth differently. I measure wealth in terms of natural resources and space, and one of the measurements with optics, I mean not optics, with measurements or metrics that we're using today that I've been talking about is spatial wealth. Two terms I want you to get familiar with: spatial wealth and spatial capital. Spatial wealth and spatial capital. When I say you can take an acre of land and put 10 basket, right, the acre represents the space. The spatial wealth is because you have spatial wealth and you have spatial capital. The spatial wealth is the amount of space that's available. It could be 1 acre, could be a half acre, could be 4/4 acres or what have you. That's the spatial wealth. The spatial capital is what you put on that acre of land. So everything I just named previously, you know, 10 basketball courts on an acre that can accommodate, that's, you know, you can, that's the wealth. Or if you want to put tomato plants on it, well, and tomato plants are a consumable item. I mean, they produce, you know, so that's 3,600. That's what you can, that's the wealth that you can turn into money or anything that you want to exchange it for. But spatial wealth and spatial capital, and going, just using a biblical term, or example rather, the feeding of the 5,000, how was that done? Well, for one, Jesus had, and let's throw these terms out there. Now, you've heard me talk about plenty of times social capital, all right? Well, let me also put out there social wealth. And we have to put out the wealth part first. Let's see, that's step one. Well, he happened to have 12 disciples. He had 12 relationships. When you think of 12 disciples, he had 12 relationships. He had 12 friends that, you know, they traveled together. They ate together, you know. You know, he was a carpenter. You know, they were fishermen. So they had their different professions. So they worked as a unit. But he had social wealth because, you know, if, let's say he got hungry because he was a man. And, you know, he didn't have any shekels or whatever. Because you never heard about any, none of those miracles you heard, except for when you heard him, you never heard him talk about, I need some money. You know, one of the fishermen said, look, man, I'm starving. Can you got any spare fish, you know, that I can, you know, whip up and cook? He had, and I'm sure that happened. You won't find it in the King James Bible. I'm improvising here, okay, because there's a lot of things that are not mentioned, but they did eat when, you know, in that three-year mission that they had together. So they were fish. He had fishermen as part of that, all right? So he had social wealth because he had relationships. Now, here's where the social capital comes in at, particularly as we're talking about the feeding of the 4,000 or 5,000. Okay. Now, when he said we don't need to send people away to eat, number one, he already knew, all right, we got 12 of us, and we got 4,000 or 5,000 people out there that are hungry. All right, and they started off small. Somebody, because Jesus had a relationship with somebody within the 12 disciples, and they had a relationship with the kid who had 2 fish and 5 loaves of bread. The 2 fish and 5 loaves of bread is the concrete social capital. They didn't need to, whoever that disciple was, they had enough of a relationship with that person where they could get access to the 5 loaves and 2 fish. Once again, this is L.A.'s interpretation or version of it, the street level interpretation of it. I am not a pastor, minister, or evangelist, or nothing like this. I'm breaking it down to you the way I understand it. Okay. But that's the social capital. Now, out of that 5,000 people, we don't know who else had, because everybody had resources out of that group. Now, what kind of resources they have, we don't know. However, we do know that Jesus had enough social wealth that gave him access to the social capital, the 2 fish and the 5 loaves of bread, that they were able to work it out where everybody ate, everybody had enough to eat. Who knows, some people probably had seconds or thirds, and there were 12 baskets left over. So if you got a tight money situation, I would suggest the first thing you do is take assessment of how much social wealth do you have? And then while you're doing that, assessing how much social wealth do you have, and let me just break that down. How many friends do you have? How many friends or how many people that you can go to for whatever you need? If you're hungry, man, I'm hungry. I ain't got $5 on me. Can you hook me up with a Big Mac? That's an example of you got the social wealth, and the social wealth to the point where you can ask somebody for Big Mac money or just a Big Mac. The Big Mac is the social capital. That's the tangibility part of it. That's what you're converting the social. You're converting the social wealth into the social capital, and the social capital is a specific thing that you need. It's just like an audio that we have 9 friends. Okay, the 9 friends, the social wealth that the guy had was he had 9 friends. The social capital that he had because of the social wealth that he had was 9 pickup trucks showed up. I'm estimating there were at least 2 people in each one of those trucks. That makes 9 times 2 human capital, because it was a human being driving the truck, and they probably bought at least 1. So that's at least 18 people. That's human capital that would provide the labor to do what they needed to do. That's 9 pickup trucks that he didn't own. But once again, if you've got the social wealth, in other words, and to simplify it, how many friends you got? Now, some people that are, and I'm not knocking this, I'm just throwing this out there. Some people that don't have the social wealth, therefore no access to social capital, might have to go to the social services office. And that's community wealth. That's community wealth. And they can probably get what they need from there. But then you don't have a social services office in every part of the United States. And many countries in the United States, many countries around the world, they don't have social services at all. So, you had to, this country basically, prior to the bankers getting in bed with society and politicians, the people that signed that Declaration of Independence, they basically built their wealth off of social wealth and social capital. They built their homes, their plantations, their businesses, basically social wealth. Now, what's the sad thing, in my opinion, about what's happening now is people blow off, matter of fact, on July 4th, 1776, also there was no such thing as the United States dollars. There was no national legal tender. So people had the money in 17, and it still exists today, but more people depend on the government's form of currency than social forms of currency. But in order to get access to the social capital, the more social wealth you have, in other words, the more friends you have, the better off you can get. So essentially, that's how we'll be building this. We're going to be acquiring more social wealth that will give us access to social capital to do what we need to do.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to, I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
All right. So the guy who bought the house, he had social wealth, which means he had access to people that liked him well enough where they would share, once again, and the social capital is those 9 trucks. He didn't own those 9 trucks. He didn't lease those 9 trucks. But he had enough social wealth where he had access to other people's capital. And that's what we call it, social capital. So I imagine you had, like say, you had about 30, 9 times 2 is 18. So that's 18 people. 2 hands each, that's 36 hands. As he stated, many hands make light work. So I'm sure they had food, refreshments, heat, you know, God knows they needed. We don't know what kind of work they did, but he said the house looked brand new on the inside and outside. So we're talking about the social capital due to the social wealth. And it, you know what? The key is, you know, it, nice, N-I-C-E. That's a small word, but it's also a big word. A lot of people don't realize if you're nice to people, you don't know how far that can go. So he had access, by him being nice, he had enough soul, and we don't know how many people he called. That's just how many people that showed up. 9 trucks showed up. I'm putting at least 2 people in each truck because they were pickup trucks. So it could have been 2 in a cab, and then 2 in the back part of the pickup truck. And more than likely there was, but I'm just being conservative. So we got 18 people, 36 hands, 38 including his two hands. So food, refreshments, hydration. Paint brushes, paint rollers, paint, drop cloths, scrapers, anything they needed to get that house looking like brand new in a matter of hours. Because if we look at just the, let's look at the human capital part, because each one of those people represents human capital. All right, just on the human capital part, you've got, let's see, I'm being conservative again, 9 people to 18, and plus him is 2. Let's see, 18, yeah, 20 people. No. 20 people, yeah. 2 people, that's 18. Yeah, 19 people. And let's say, let's put 8 hours on the clock. That's 152 human hours, human capital hours, or 152 labor hours. Didn't have to write a check. Didn't have to tap into the bank account. But you got to have your social wealth together first. So if you're in need of a large sum of money for anything, I would say the first step, and you getting that money, or in some cases a miracle, the first step you need to take assessment of is, how many friends do you have? You don't want these friends for money now. Just how many friends can you go to? Second thing is, what kind of social capital is available, which is resources, that you can use to, now in this case, he needed labor. He needed refreshments. Because your workers can't, they got to be refreshed. They can't be on an empty stomach. He needed, like I say, he could have needed miter saws, drills, impact drivers, tile layers, joint compound. We don't know what he needed, but they supplied it. And that's what I call social capital. That's the tangible stuff that, you know, if you're house sitting for somebody, you know, if you got keys to the house, that's the social capital right there. But you have to have the social wealth intact first. There had to be some type of relationship, a positive relationship, for you to get the social capital in the form of keys. The social capital can take place, in so many ways, it morphs, keys, cars, airplane tickets, hamburgers, hot dogs, clothes on your back. I mean, social capital can morph into so many different ways, but you got to have the social wealth. In other words, you have to have the positive relationships intact first in order for have that. So, like I said, now when you combine that with what can you do with an acre, so if you're trying to buy 20 acres, which we're trying to do, not trying to do, we're doing, or 40 acres or whatever, okay, it's, you know, just look at the power of 1 acre. Just as a review, once again, an acre could be 10 basketball courts, 16 tennis courts, 144 to 242 parking spaces, 5 houses that have a front yard, backyard, and a driveway, throw in a garage, and maybe a couple of carports. 3,600 tomato plants. I don't know how many plants come on. I don't know how many fruit or tomatoes, or, you know, the typical tomato can, produce, you know, but 3,600 plants, that you can put that on an acre. 325,851 gallons of water. And you know what I keep on forgetting? Let me look this up right now. Okay. And you can look it up with me. Go to any search engine. What I want you to look up, and I'm looking it up to number of liters of water, number of liters of rainwater on 1 acre of land. Okay, so we don't want 1 square mile. We want on, all right, how many liters are, all right, I want rainwater. All right, it says here 20,000 to 40,000. Oh, wait a minute. So be prepared for, okay, be prepared for 60 to 100, or hold it. Now I'm going to take this first one. 20,000 to 40,000 per acre. But I want rainwater. But you know what? It depends on how long it rains, too. All right. Let me see. How much rainwater is it? How many gallons? Let's see if it rains for 20 minutes. How much rainwater? Well, let's go with 10 minutes. How much rainwater in 10 minutes if they measure this way. I know they measure in inches on 1 acre. We might have to start using AI to give, you know, because AI is still in its infancy. Sometimes AI gives you right answers. Sometimes AI doesn't give you right answers. But I'm guessing some engineers are working on that. Let's see, on 1 acre. And some of you who are taking municipal water right now, you might want to think about harvesting your own rainwater because municipal water is going up due to inflation, and they got to replace infrastructure in a lot of places like Detroit, Flint, Michigan, Baltimore, Maryland, those, any city of any size. So you might want to consider, you can do it two ways. In some areas, like in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, it's illegal to do your own well. That's out. You don't have that option in D.C. Okay. I don't know how they feel about harvesting rainwater in D.C. yet, but in many places around the country, you can harvest rainwater as well as groundwater. So that's one of the first things I look at when I'm looking at a piece of land. One of the first questions I ask, can I put my own well there? If I can't put a well on it, I don't bother with it. It's point blank. That's another reason why I like raw land. Okay, rainwater per acre. All right, 1 inch of rain falling on 1 acre of ground is equal to 27,154 gallons of water, and it weighs 113 tons. An inch of snow falling evenly on an acre of ground is equivalent to 2,715 gallons of water. All right, so where I'm at, this particular thing we're at, that's abundance. And most people, see, that's why I measure my wealth in terms of people, space, and natural resources. I don't measure it in terms of dollars and cents, as most people do, as Forbes does. I measure it in, once again, space, natural resources, that type of thing. So, all right, so in addition to, all right, you got some groundwater, right? You got a constant state of 325,851 gallons of groundwater. And then in addition to that, when it rains, you have an additional 27,154 gallons of water. Now, the key is you want to harvest that rainwater and store it. So you got two sources. So, I mean, that's why, man, in my opinion, going rural is where it's at. Most people are not going for that, the rural thing. Because they have been, and now this is me speaking. They are addicted, and I say addicted, to the comfort and conveniences of what a large municipality has to offer. But you got to pay for it. And in a lot of these places, you virtually have to be a millionaire and or wealthy person to live in, like Seattle, Washington. Man, if you ain't got $1 million, you're not buying a house in Seattle, Washington. That's the median price. That's the median price. You know, half sell for less, half sell for more. They meet in the middle at $1 million in Seattle, Washington. Okay. So, no, I don't want your municipal water. I'll go out, and the country could be 15 minutes away, 20 minutes away, or it could be an hour away, 90 minutes away, or 2 hours away. But give me a place where I can, when it rains, and I get an inch of water, and I got, and you know what? You're not going to use 27,000 acres, gallons of water right away. But why ever buy, you can produce your own. Matter of fact, some of these bottled waters that we buy in stores right now, some of that stuff is tap water. Anyway, I'm off my soapbox. So anyway, the power of one, that's the power of 1 acre. And that's all I'm going to say on it because I don't want to get on another tangent, this being Friday and all. So let's see. All right, 8:13, your mic is open. Any comments?
Hello.
Good morning, Robin.
Good morning. So about the collecting rainwater, you have to check the county because in some places, it's against the code to collect rainwater. And then it's you want to make sure that the container that you're storing it in is, you know, meant for that, because when you store it, you have to worry about it being contaminated or growing mold or other. Am I making sense to you? So, you know, it's not, oh, you just get a barrel and collect the water. It's a process that you want to research, you know, and study before you approach it. Yes, I just wanted to throw that in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's true. But like I said, that's the first question I ask before when I'm buying land is really, literally, that's the first question. Can I, you know, water rights? So anyway, I've purchased land. You can do that. Then we'll have people out that we'll have classes on an ongoing basis on groundwater, wells, filtering systems like reverse osmosis. That's what I have at where I'm at right now, as well as rainwater, you know, how to harvest that and how to bottle it, and then even how to monetize either one of them if you want to do that. So we'll have ongoing educational classes on water. Delmore around it. Did he call in? Okay, we don't hear him. All right, so we'll be right back right after this. We'll be right back.
Hear ye, hear ye. The court's in session. The court's in session. Now here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge. Here come the judge. Here come the judge. Here come the judge.
I'll be at first. Cause here come the judge. Don't nobody first. Cause here come the judge. Judge Shorty. Take no stuff from nobody, no kind of way. Hey boy, take off that hat. Where do you think you're at? I know where you gon' be if you don't need my lead. I'm here to tell you. Can't nobody smoke tonight. Here come the judge. Here come the judge.
To our topic today, lead jump off topic, power of 1 acre and one tiny house built per day. I want to throw this out there. I just thought about this. As we haven't had a reparations talk on here in a while, and we're gearing this towards reparations in the United States because there are people wanting reparations in different forms around the world. But anyway, so right here in the United States, and even here in the United States, you have different ethnic groups that want reparations. Like in Hawaii, you know, you have some Native Hawaiians, they want reparations. They don't want statehood. They, look, give us back the Kingdom of Hawaii and, you know, don't be pushing us out and don't be pricing us out and we're good. But no, I'm talking about reparations in the form of reparations for, I guess, what they call the group. Ados, African descendants of slaves, that group. And my question is, would you ever have a reparations check? And let's say it's $1 million check. Would you rather have a reparations? Oh, you know what? Let me go to some. They passed a reparations bill in, it's not Harvey, Illinois. It's a town about hours north of Chicago, Evanston. They passed a reparations bill in Evanston, Illinois. Now, their reparations bill is not based on what they call slavery. It's based on, discrimination or whatever in that town. So would you rather have a reparations allotment, and for them, I have to find out what it is. But let's say, would you rather get a reparations check, or no? They have like a down payment assistance thing. I think that's one of the options for reparations in Evanston, Illinois. Would you rather have that, or would you rather have an acre of land? Once again, on an acre of land, you can put up 10 basketball courts or 16 tennis courts. It's got space for over 144. It can accommodate over for at least 144 vehicles, 500 trees, 3,600 tomato plants, and over 325,000 gallons of water. Over, let's see, did I read right? 13 tons of rainwater. If an inch of water lands on that on that acre. And I want to put this, let's elevate this to the world stage. Reparations in the United States in Evanston, Illinois, or to the ADOs, African descendants of slaves in the United States, because a lot of them, particularly the California people, they want a check. All right? They want their reparations in the form of a check. Or, now let's also look at Russia. Russia, a country that's on two continents. Part of Russia is in Europe, but the most of Europe is in, most of Russia is in Asia. Russia's got 11 time zones. Natural resources out the yin-yang, yet they want Ukraine too. And then, you know, we got a happening going on in Israel. They're fighting over land. Now here, what we're talking about is nobody fighting. And there's virtually almost no competition. And in some things, there's no competition. So we're going to go to the phone lines. I want you, what's your take on it? You know, would you rather have reparations? And now now this is just me personally. Give me the acre of land. Give me the acre of land. You can keep the check. Because I know what to do. And I don't even know what I can do with an acre. That's what I named over here. That's just some. There's more that can be done with an acre than what I just named. I'm still learning what can you do with this one. So you know what? Give me. Matter of fact, I can make $1 million by just selling bottled water off an acre of land. So you can keep the reparations check, but that's me. I'm crazy. I'm an extremist. Okay, so. We're going to take your opinion on that when we come back.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees of war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh, Lord, yeah.
War pigs. Bottom line, with most wars, it's over natural resources that are contained within an acre of land. Ukraine and Russia and Ukraine been at it for over a year now. Ukraine's a whole bunch of acres. We call it a country, though, but that's, you know, like I say, as big as Russia is, they're going for a whole country because they want those acres. They know the power contained within an acre. And Israel, much smaller on your map, geographically speaking, but they're fighting over land. The power of 1 acre. Like I said, I don't even know how much, you know, because you know what, after those wars are over with, you know, people like Halliburton, they'll come in, there's a whole, look out, there's billions, of, almost on the verge of trillions of dollars that they're going to make in infrastructure, you know, rebuilding roads, bridges, that type of thing. But all those things are all within an acre. Now, in this country, and once again, I'm putting out there, do you want that reparations check? Or do you want an acre of land? Which one do you want? Now, let me put this out here on the landscape of the United States. In the United States, and I'll read this verbatim, A review by NBC News of thousands of documents filed by the United States, filed with the United States Department of Agriculture, shows that very few purchases by Chinese buyers in the past year and a half of fewer than 1,400 acres. Now, let's see. Another article says, is China really buying up U.S. farmland? Now, let me tell you this. In this state where I'm at, Florida, Governor DeSantis, this year in 2023, barred Chinese folks from buying any additional land in the state of Florida. I wonder why. See, we that already live here, we need to take advantage of the opportunities that are here. One of them is land, rural land, farmland, land where, no, there's no Walmart near there. No, the bus line and the metro, no, there's not a bus stop here. There's no metro station. No, the nightclub's not here. In many places, they don't even have a hospital. Now, we have an opportunity, like Jacksonville, Florida, 90 minutes away from there, there's a bunch of areas where all rural, but once again, but for some reason, that's why I say it's an addiction for most, as a matter of fact, just not Americans, but people around the globe, go to London or Moscow or Johannesburg or Shanghai, Beijing, China. Most humans on the planet, not all, but most humans on the planet are addicted to municipal living on the same level as a crack addict. Now, why would I use an extreme example like a crack addict? Because if you ever met a crack, they just can't do without that crack. But most people, particularly that listen to this podcast, they are addicted to municipal living. They don't want a well. They don't want it. They want to turn a knob and get municipal water. They don't want to deal with solar panels. They want to flick a switch and have the lights on. You know, many people want to live in a HOA, a homeowners association. I wouldn't, but a lot of people do because they're addicted to the. Now, if you take that same person and put them in the middle of Alaska, they're not going to make it. Because they do not, the mainstream educational system has not educated them on how to build their own house. You know, it's interesting. If you look up the background of the people who signed that Declaration of Independence, a lot of them had built it. A lot of them had skills that the average person with a PhD from Harvard or Yale doesn't have today. They knew how to hunt, fish, catch their food, grow their food, forage for food. You know, if they wanted to build a house, you know, they were on friendly enough terms with friends and relatives, as the Amish and the Mennonites are today, where, you know, so what? They didn't have a Bank of America back then. FHA hadn't been invented yet, and, of course, the United States dollar wasn't even legislated into existence until 16 years after the Declaration of Independence was formed. So it was a different economy. And that economy does still exist in different parts of the world, including the United States. But hold it. I got sidetracked. Let's go back to the Chinese. So in Florida, Governor DeSantis outlawed Chinese from buying additional farmland. Now, as I'm looking on my phone, why is China, I'm reading this now, why is China buying land in North Dakota? Recent reporting shows that the CCP, that's China, affiliate corporation, purchased farmland in North Dakota that is just a stone's throw away from the high culpability military bases. The purchases raise possibility. Now, I can go... Look at the 100 1,000 people that are homeless in New York City right now. If I was one of them, I'd be headed to North Dakota. I'm just saying. Okay. Let's see. Who is the largest foreign owner of U.S. farmland? Canadians are. Let's see. Chinese own quite a bit as well. Chinese companies and individuals own farmland in the U.S. Chinese firms, let me open up this article. This is from NPR. China owns 380,000 acres of land in the United States, and here's where. In 2021, a Chinese company bought land near Air Force Base in Grand Forks, North Dakota, sending North lawmakers into a frenzy. And this is all online. You can read it. Meanwhile, you know, I'm not even going to get into that. But back to the question, let's see. Oh, wait a minute. What's happening in Arkansas? Arkansas is forcing Chinese company to sell off farmland. See, a lot of these foreign nationals, individuals and companies, they're going into the non-sexy areas. You know, who goes on vacation in Arkansas? I'm sure some people do, but Arkansas, Oklahoma, you know, once you get outside the Golden Triangle in Texas, you know, like Presidio County, Colbert County, you know, Brewster County, Texas, you know, those are unsexy parts of Texas. But that's where you can get land rich. Once again, here's what I suggest. Sit down today or this weekend and then reassess how you measure wealth. Reassess how you measure wealth. Like I said, I measure wealth in a form of social capital or social wealth, natural resources, land, water, trees, you know, food that you can catch or grow on that, and spatial wealth, which goes on with land or whatever. But anyway, before we run out of time, let me go to the phone lines here. 254 area code, your mic is open.
Hello?
Yeah, your mic is open.
I want to start with
Okay, we can. You got a lot of background noise.
Yeah, I'm at a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
As you say, I participated in that. And didn't realize that until this morning. So I have a house back in San Antonio. And,
I can barely hear you because of the background noise.
Okay. I'll step outside. I'll call back.
Oh, okay. All right. And we'll wait for him to call back. Anybody, but yeah, do you want to bite on that? Like I say, now, of course, if you do get a reparations in the form of check, but in Evanston, Illinois, matter of fact, let's go look that up. Evanston, Illinois. Evans, let's see. Booker T. Washington laid this all out years ago. Evanston, Illinois. Reparations. Let's see what they have going up there. All right, in 2019, Evanston, Illinois passed the first reparations law in American history. Okay, who is eligible for reparations? In African-American or black individuals who are at least 18 years old and living in Evanston between 1919 and 1969 as descendants of Evanston residents during that time. All right, what is the city of Evanston, Illinois, on Monday, the Chicago suburb city council voted 8-1 to distribute $400,000 to eligible, so in Evanston, Illinois, their reparations, it's not $400,000 per person, it's $400,000 to eligible black households. All right. Give me the acre or more. Yeah, I'll take that. Because with 1 acre, now the city has pledged, the city of Evanston has pledged to distribute $10 million over 10 years. So that's $1 million a year. Now, there are videos on YouTube that they show you how to take a quarter of an acre of land and get $100,000 worth of revenue out of a quarter acre of land. That's just on YouTube. Anyway, so it looks like Evanston is not cutting checks. They went through a process. The voters voted for it. The politicians put it out there. And that's what the citizens of Evanston wanted. So if they want it, so be it. You know, the state of California, they want it a little bit different. But let's see how that turns out. That's still a work in process. But like I say, there's a lot of power in 1 acre. And, I mean, this weekend, I named seven or eight on the podcast today. So there's a lot there. Let me see, open up, because Willie was in a restaurant. Okay, Robin or Delma, are you there? Okay, I'm going to just leave their mic open. All right, Willie's got 3 more minutes to call, so let me see. Do I have a 3-minute bit? Oh, here's a 14-year-old that built a tiny house. Oh, you know what? Oh, let's see what he's doing.
Hi, my name is Kelvin Krushank Odate. My African dream is the Kejols.
Imagine living in a space that measures a mere 168 square feet, more than 14 times smaller than the average American home. Well, it is here inside this tiny house where the proud owners are discovering that less is so much more.
Well, in the past year, we've managed to save everything that I earn. We use my husband's income for our living expenses, and I've been teaching public school, so that's about $3,000 a month that we've put in the bank this year.
Hari, her husband Carl, and their two young kids Archer and Ella recently celebrated their one-year anniversary in their tiny house. After losing their 1,500-square-foot home to financial struggles, the couple took matters into their own hands, literally. They built this space themselves with just $13,000 in materials. Their goal? To become debt-free and save enough to one day build a new home, mortgage-free. And so far, they're right on track.
Things are going really well with the next project. We're going to build a 16 by 24 unit to begin with, and then we'll branch off of that and add bedrooms.
You may remember seeing this family on The Anderson Show earlier this year, where I joined them on stage. Fascinated by their story, our financially fit team flew down to Virginia to see for ourselves and learn ways we can all downsize.
How are you? Hey, really good.
You. Hey there. Living in the tiny house has taught me that we don't need much at all to be happy, and that getting the things that we need can actually be a lot of fun.
Can you get me a bowl and some scissors?
The family's fruit and vegetable garden lets them eat healthier, cut down on their carbon footprint, and slash their grocery bill by as much as 30%. Hari has also been upcycling, as she calls it, taking something old and breathing new life into it.
My favorite upcycling project was the rugs I made for the house. I took old sheets, flat sheets, and crocheted them into rugs. They're beautiful, and they fit the house a lot nicer than if we had gone and bought something new from the store.
The couple also recently switched jobs, not for more money, but more happiness. Carl is enjoying better working conditions at a new restaurant, and Hari left teaching to pursue a career in nonprofit. Being able to afford a career that you love and pursuing a passion rather than a paycheck, they've learned, is just an added benefit to having savings and no debt.
I'm probably taking a 25 to 30% cut in my salary, which is going to enable me to have more time to actually build the house and save money because I'll be the contractor.
It's really a great feeling to be able to make a decision like that, not based on money, but based on what we want to be doing with our time.
The kids also seem keen to the transition. Mom and Dad are happy to report fewer requests for video games or toys now that Ella and Archer are busy playing outdoors on their 3-acre property.
We play down by the creek and up at the big tree up there where the swing is. We play with our neighbors and ride bikes.
There's a lot of different things they can do with their time besides play with plastic toys and get online.
They've really just embraced it wholeheartedly. You can't stop them from having a good time outside.
Still another lesson, when you downsize, it helps to have a support system.
There's such a wealth of knowledge in our community, and that helps us a lot. And having that support makes it like we're doing it together. Moving to the country has given us a lot of things, not just the tiny house.
So, what do you think? What are your thoughts about living in a tiny house? Would you ever do it? Connect with me on Twitter at Farnoosh and use the hashtag FinFit. For Yahoo Finance, I'm Farnoosh Tarabi.
Oh, quick, here's another thing you can do with a tiny house before we go back to Willie on the phone line. All right, now, they built a 186-square-foot tiny house. Here's another metric. I always pay attention to the woman involved. Happy wife, happy life, okay? The wife is happy. She's able to bank her whole paycheck of $3,000 a month into the bank. All right. Now, 186 square feet, you can fit 234 tiny houses in an acre of land. 234 of them. And they spent $13,000 in building that. So if we build and sell 234 tiny houses, or if you copy it off of them and you do it 233 more times than they did and sell it, okay, you can make over $3 million. There's a lot of power in 1 acre of land. Let's go to the phone lines to close out for the day. Yes, Willie, your mic is open.
Okay, what I was going to say is that, first off, when you start off with the social capital, I didn't realize I had used social capital in the past because I had, I had a house in San Antonio. I befriended the sanitation workers that would come by the house. And because they would, I had a corner house, they would have lunch on the side of the house. And so I befriended them, and the house needed painting. So in talking with them, I said, oh, yeah, my brother-in-law paints. And he says, but he'll need a six-pack. So I talked to the brother-in-law. He told me he's going to charge me. Now, the house is only the house is only 1,100 square foot house, and and so he said he would charge. This is back in the '80s. He said he would charge me $220 to paint the house, and I buy the paint. I said that's a deal.
Okay.
So he showed up with six friends.
There you go.
And they had that house painted in like 4 hours. They were through. And it was a fantastic job. But I gave
Hold on, man, I'm listening.
Yeah, I paid him $220 and a six pack.
That's social capital at work.
Six friends.
With six
and
friends.
You're talking about the, and six friends. And so I gave him another $100 because he had brought his friends with him. But they finished in like 4 hours. All of them out there, like you say, the music's playing. Everybody, you know. Plus, they brought some more beer with them. So, you know. But that's
well,
what he wanted.
Now that,
and he did a fantastic job. So.
That is an excellent, excellent example of social capital at work. And it all started with you making, you know, made friends. You don't have no alternative motive for this. It's just, you know, making friends and, oh, by the way, I got, you know, that's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Right. And I didn't bring that up until like 6-8 months later. You know, we're just talking. And who knew that the sanitation worker's brother-in-law would paint the house that was a, had painting skills? You know, who knew?
Exactly.
No, I didn't know anything.
Exactly. Well, that Willie, that is an excellent example of social capital at work. And well, you know, all of us have social capital. It's just you know, it you know, a lot of people just don't know what it is or how to recognize or how to use it. So I'm gonna end it on that today because we can't top that testimony you just shared. On that note, thank you, Willie. Thank you, everybody, for calling in. Everybody have a great weekend.